You didn't know. You can only work with what you know. Still feel bad about it, he grumbled. What bugs me is I should have scanned the flower after we took control. I would have detected the quantum links. I can't explain why I didn't do that. Joe, this is where my inability to access sections of my memory concerns me.
Mr. Skippy, Desai asked, does this mean you can remotely control Kristang ships in the future?
Yes. Yes, I can, as long as we're close enough. The Theranin are constantly changing their control codes, and their encryption is pretty good, so I need to bypass the Theranin control system and activate the nanovirus directly. Short answer, yes, I can do it. Long answer?
Meh, it depends.
I wouldn't want to count on it in a critical combat situation. I gave an exaggerated shrug. And once again, you are filling me with confidence, Skippy. Hey, it's better than what we had before, and I'm working on it. The technology the Theranin are using isn't quite right. It's corrupted from the original. The Elders abandoned this type of crew technology a long, long time ago. I'm having to dig through my memory to figure out how it's supposed to work, and if I can fix it, then I can control it much more easily. Give me some time. Your time. Not my super-fast time.
Hey, Colonel Joe, are you asleep?
Skippy's voice rang out of the speaker in the ceiling of my sleeping compartment. I bolted upright and whacked my head on a low-hanging cabinet. Before I tried going to sleep in the tiny bed, I figured that cabinet would be a problem, so I hung two pairs of pants over it as padding. Probably saved me from a concussion. Next night, it was time to try sleeping on the floor. The Theranin beds were too small.
Damn it, Skippy, you made me crack my head.
Rubbing my scalp made it worse. Stop rubbing it made it worse, too.
What is it? I asked as I stumbled to my feet, ready to run out the door to the bridge. The Max Holtz cruiser found us?
No, no danger, Joe. Good news. I have good news. My Z-phone said it was 0134 hours. I'd been sleeping for less than 3 hours, and my duty shift on the bridge started in another 3.5 hours.
There is no good news at this time of night, Skippy.
I settled back in the bed as best I could, alternating between rubbing my head and letting it throb painfully.
Can this wait until morning?
There is no sunrise on a starship, Joe.
Oh, for crying out. What is it?
Clearly he was not going away.
Among the data I pulled from that command ship is an interesting analysis of the Kristang asteroid base where we're going. The Theranin have been monitoring it closely for years. They've mapped the gaps and vulnerabilities of the Kristang defenses.
Oh, that is good news.
It's going to be easy?
That would be a no, Joe. This is a tough nut to crack. The Theranin analysis, and I've confirmed their analysis from the raw data, is that the Kristang have done a very good job of hardening their defenses, specifically against the Theranin. Despite their best efforts at secrecy, the Kristang think it reasonably likely the Theranin are at least aware there is a research facility in the asteroid, and they have gone to considerable trouble and expense to prevent the Theranin from swooping in and stealing their goodies.
Well, crap. Now he'd ruined my sleep.
It's impossible, then?
No, I didn't say that. The Theranin can take the asteroid if they really want to, and the Kristang know it. The point of the Kristang defenses is to make it difficult enough for the Theranin that the Theranin will decide raiding the asteroid isn't worth the cost.
I shook my head in the darkness. Great alliance the Max Hulks have assembled. Everyone has to worry about getting screwed by their allies as much as they worry about the enemy.
It is a weakness for them, yes.
Bottom line, Skippy, I asked because of his tendency to ramble on. Is raiding this asteroid worth it to us? You made it sound like we don't have much of a choice.
You don't have any choice that I know of. The only reference I can find to an Elder Wormhole controller module is at this asteroid.
Elder artifacts aren't something you can find on eBay, Joe.
We get it from this asteroid base, or you give up on shutting down that wormhole.
He maddeningly hadn't answered my question.
All right, it's worth it to us.
I'll ask this slowly so you'll understand. Lack of sleep makes me cranky. Can we do it? With this ship and the people and equipment we have on board?
Wait a minute.
That little shithead was likely to misunderstand anyway. I'll be more specific. Do we have a good chance of success?
Oh, sure. No problemo, Joe. Even better now that I have more data.
The Theranin have been probing the Kristang defenses around the asteroid, partly to evaluate the Kristang's level of technological development, and partly because the Theranin are hateful little MFers who love to screw with lesser species. With the Theranin having done the first part of the job for us, I know how to sneak right up to the front gate, so to speak. The Theranin got very close. Their reports indicate blind spots in the Kristang sensor network. Like I said, this is good news.
Good news that could have waited until I woke up.
Sorry about that, Joe. You can go back to Dreamland now.
Yeah, like that's going to happen now.
Hey, wait a minute. It had been 11 hours since we jumped away from the Theranin battle group. It took your enormous brain all this time to decode the Theranin data and analyze it? You said you were so fast that us monkeys couldn't even conceive of it.
I did have to decrypt over a zettabyte of data, Skippy said defensively, as if I had any idea what a zettabyte was,
from a surprisingly sophisticated encryption scheme. Then organize it, decide what to analyze first, then analyze a lot of conflicting data to make sense of it.
Oh, sorry, Skippy. I didn't mean to insult him. I'm sure it was a lot of work even for you.
Oh, no, it took me only 7 minutes. Seemed like forever, though.
You knew all this a couple minutes after we jumped away?
Yep.
Why the hell did you wake me up in the middle of the freaking night?
I was bored, Joe. And lonely.
And that's all he said. His silence made me stifle the angry remark I had ready. Skippy and I had been in almost continuous contact since he'd sprung me from the closet where the Ruha had been keeping me. Before that, he'd had no contact with anyone for a very long time, perhaps millions of years. He'd been able to listen in on other people's conversations after the Kristang first arrived on Paradise to alleviate some of his boredom. That may have intensified his loneliness. Hearing other people interact and being excluded. And thinking about that reminded me that I was the first person, the first being, that Skippy had talked to since whatever had happened to him that caused his isolation. With me sleeping, he'd been like a junkie needing a fix.
Sorry about that, Skippy. You do understand that us monkeys need to sleep, right? There are other people aboard. Can you talk to them?
Most of the crew was sleeping. Chang and two pilot trainees were on the bridge, and one person was in the sick bay. Although anyone pulling a shift in the sick bay could catch a nap while the wounded were sleeping, or sedated, or unconscious, or whatever Dr. Skippy the mad scientist thought was best for them.
They're not comfortable talking with me. Most of them are scared of me.
I'll talk to them about that, Skippy. In the morning, okay? I'm scheduled to be on the bridge again in, like, a little over 3 hours. Can you do a crossword puzzle or something until then?
I guess so.
You want me to play a lullaby for you?
A pillow over my head didn't block him out enough.
Good night, Skippy. When I woke up and was in a better mood, I asked Skippy about his plan to raid the asteroid. Not a detailed plan. I needed to get Giro to work on that soon. For now, all I wanted was to hear the basic concept from Skippy.
You had time to review all the data about the asteroid layout and defenses, right? How do we get inside the place?
Oh, I have a totally brilliant plan, Colonel Joe. We'll use Theranin dropships, Skippy explained patiently. I can get the outer landing bay doors open and fool their sensors so the Kristang can't shoot at the dropships. After the dropships land, the crew will rush the inner doors and blow them open.
Rush the door in a depressurized landing bay?
Skippy, none of us will fit into a Theranin spacesuit. They're too small.
There was a millisecond pause that I now knew was an eternity in AI time.
Well, shit, Skippy finally said.
Well, shit?
Seriously, this isn't a joke. You didn't think about us humans needing spacesuits in space? Let me define spacesuit for you. Two words. The first is space. I'm not a meat sack. I don't think like you biological trash bags. This biological trash bag is going to take a big dump on your lid and throw you out in airlock. That would be a better threat if I didn't control all of the airlock mechanisms, monkey boy.
Airlocks have manual overrides. Ooh, look, monkey has opposable thumbs. I waggled my thumbs at his lid.
Shut up.
Well, I'm thinking, Skippy shouted defensively.
I can smell the smoke.
What?
The next time you think of telling me how godlike smart you are, just remember spacesuits. Oh, shut up. Never said I was perfect.
Go back to square one and rethink your plan, I said as I headed into the tiny bathroom. I want to discuss it with Giroux this afternoon so he can start fixing your screw-ups. That's in about 10 hours, which is a bazillion years in Skippy time, so you'll have plenty of opportunity to come up with ideas that don't include humans breathing hard vacuum.
Private Randall approached me in the gym that morning while I was sweating away with Sergeant Adams's improved equipment, and he reported that Major Sims was satisfied the crew had completed the familiarization drills, that everyone now knew where the airlocks were, how to operate trams and lifts, where their duty stations were, and a whole list of emergency procedures that Chang and Sims insisted on and Skippy thought were a complete waste of time.
Joe, this crew, trying to learn how to operate this ship, is a waste of time. You're like a dog. A dog may know that inside the pantry is a yummy box of treats, but it can stare at that doorknob all day and it's never going to understand how it works.
And so we're dogs now, I winked at Randall. When do we get a promotion? I thought we were all bacteria to you.
You have performed better than expected overall. Your species is reasonably adaptable. Maybe I can consider you more like a paramecium.
Wait, a para what? Randall asked.
Paramecium. I pronounced it slowly. It's a single-cell organism. You probably looked at one through a microscope in high school. They look kind of like a paisley. That drew a blank stare from Randall.
A paisley?
I struggled to think how to explain paisley. Those funky swirly patterns on old people's couches or curtains. Kind of like half a yin-yang symbol.
Huh. I didn't know there was a name for those.
Randall nodded. Skippy made a disgusted noise.
I changed my mind again. You idiots are bacteria. Who doesn't know what a paisley is?
We're soldiers, I explained. Not interior designers, Chrome Dome.
Paisley would be a great unit symbol for your merry band of pirates, Joe. I'll get the fabricators to crank out a bunch of them.
True to his word, later that day, Skippy did produce patches of a paramecium with a pirate eye patch and a dagger. Adams brought a sample of patches to me, figuring I'd get a good laugh out of it. I expected that would be the end of it, until some of the crew asked me if they could use the patches on their uniforms. That shouldn't have surprised me. We were pirates, and wearing a paramecium was the crew's way to give the finger to Skippy. That was how our merry band of bloodthirsty pirates ended up wearing paisley. On my way out of our makeshift gym, I passed Sergeant Adams as she was heading into the gym, a towel slung over one shoulder.
Sergeant, let's discuss your attire.
I thought we were good to wear T-shirts on deck, sir, unless we are going into action, she asked, pointedly looking at my gray shirt with Army across the chest.
I only have 3 tops aboard, sir.
You're okay to wear a T-shirt, Adams, I smiled. But we're on a starship, heading boldly into space where no human has been before, potentially having to land on planets with unimaginable dangers.
Sir, yes?
And you're wearing a red shirt.
Oh. She blushed as she got the old Star Trek reference.
Yes, sir. I'll be sure to change into a Marine Corps utility uni before we beam down anywhere.
You do that. I gave her a smile. Carry on. I was proud of myself that I didn't turn to watch her shapely behind as she walked away. This could be a very long trip.
Chapter 15 Raid Giroux pinged me. He needed to talk about the plan to raid the asteroid base. I found him, along with Sergeant Thompson, in a cargo bay near the gym. Skippy told me he'd been working with Giroux on an assault plan, and I let Giroux work without unhelpful interference from me.
"Good morning, sir," Sergeant Thompson said in his charming British accent.
"Good morning," I replied, still tasting the sludge I'd had for breakfast.
That morning I tried mixing the unsuccessful apple cinnamon sludge with the chocolate sludge. That wasn't too bad. The result was something I was happy to gulp down as quickly as possible so I didn't have to taste it. There was an unspoken competition among the crew to find good flavor combinations, which were then posted on our internal Z-Phone network. My experiment that morning was going into the fail column.
Lieutenant, I see you've been busy.
Yes, sir, Giroux nodded.
When he'd signed up for the mission, I'd gotten the impression that he regarded me as a bit of a lucky fool,
Someone who had the keys to the future but didn't know how to use them, and needing professional soldiers like Giraud to make the important decisions. He probably still had a less-than-stellar impression of my tactical planning skills, but there was a grudging respect for the way I'd handled the overall mission so far. My idea to get rid of our Krestang problem by jumping their starships into a planet had impressed a lot of people. That, and the fact that the mission had been resoundingly successful so far and gone exactly as I'd promised. We'd escaped from Paradise, captured a Krestang frigate and a Theranin star carrier, and were now jumping toward a wormhole. Success encourages confidence. I needed to keep the successes coming.
The plan to raid the asteroid requires the element of surprise. We need to move quickly once the dropships are in the landing bay. That means the assault team can't wait for the bay doors to cycle closed and the bay to repressurize. They must exit the dropships and gain access to the base interior before the Krestang can react. To do that, they need spacesuits.
Giraud gestured to a rack that held two spacesuits, a small suit that looked lightweight, and a larger suit that was bulky and heavily armored.
This Theranin suit, he pointed to the small one, won't fit even our shortest crew member. Skippy told me there is no way to expand the size of these suits. These ships' fabrication facilities don't have the capacity to produce the materials.
True, Skippy agreed over the speaker in the bulkhead.
Theranin battle groups include support ships with full fabrication facilities. Individual warships only have limited ability for fabrication.
That was a serious problem, Giraud continued, until Sergeant Thompson thought of the spacesuits on our Krestang ship. These suits are armored and powered for combat. Motors in the limbs enhance the wearer's movements, so the weight will not be a problem for humans.
The Krestang suit did look cool. I walked up to it and wrapped my knuckles on the armor. It was solid. Weapons could be attached to brackets at the wrists, so the wearer only needed to control the trigger. The faceplate was some kind of smoked glass. Maybe it wasn't even glass. Iron Man, or a mech suit from Halo, or a dozen other video games came to mind when I looked at the suit.
Good thinking, Sergeant. The next question is, are these suits too big?
That is a problem, Giraud admitted. Thompson went around to the back of the Krestang suit with the back hinged open and carefully stepped inside it. Giraud helped him suit up and get the back closed. Status indicators lit up on the wrist displays, and the suit took two careful steps forward. Then the faceplate reacted so I could see Thompson's face.
It's not ideal, Thompson said, his words distorted.
His face was hidden from the nose down.
My chin hits the bottom of the helmet. I can't open my mouth all the way to speak properly.
Sergeant Thompson is almost 2 meters tall, Giraud said.
That's 6'4" to you, Joe, Skippy added helpfully.
And he is barely able to use the suit effectively, Giraud continued. The suit can be adjusted, and Skippy says he can fabricate some components for us.
A limited number of components, Skippy cautioned. Don't get too excited.
How much of an adjustment? I stood on my toes to look in the helmet. Thompson did not appear to be comfortable.
The maximum adjustment for practical use in combat is limited to people 6 feet and taller, Skippy stated.
I'm 6'3", I mused.
Who else?
Thompson and Giraud were tall, so was Chang.
8 people.
Giraud ticked off on his fingers.
Me, you, Sergeant Thompson, Colonel Chang, Specialist Putri, and Privates Marsden, Darcy, and Putri.
8 people? Is that enough for a successful raid? I asked.
7 people, Giraud corrected me.
You're not going on the raid, sir. You need to remain aboard the Dutchman and command the operation.
He's right, Joe, Skippy added. I'll be here flying the dropships and monitoring sensors. Somebody needs to tell me what to do.
Trying to keep the irritation off my face, I said tersely, We'll discuss that later.
Are 6 people enough to achieve the mission?
No, Giraud stated flatly.
I agree, Joe, Skippy said. This is where we need your military genius. I could hammer the asteroid open with rail guns and then we search through the debris, but that's too much risk of damaging the items we need.
Lieutenant, I addressed my remark to Giraud.
You have Special Forces training and experience. If you think we can't achieve mission success, then I don't have anything to add.
Giraud frowned.
We are, as you Americans say, back to square one. We are not giving up. I'm sure you've considered everything. Let's step back, take a break, and approach this again tomorrow with a fresh set of eyes.
Giraud helped Thompson out of the Cristang combat suit. Thompson moved his stiff shoulders. The suit had barely fit him, and the edges of the suit had dug deeply under his arms.
"Sergeant," I asked while examining the Theranin spacesuit, "if that Cristang suit is properly adjusted, are you confident you could use it in combat?"
"Yes, sir. When it moves, it's almost effortless. With practice, we can be deadly with these suits.
We're fortunate the Cristang weren't able to use these suits when we took the flower."
"Good. Good." I was distracted. The Theranin suit was lightweight, almost flimsy. Even assuming it was made of exotic high-tech material, I couldn't see how it could compete in combat against a Cristang suit.
"Skippy, these Theranin suits are like spandex. Does this material harden into diamond or something like that? Or do they have, like, energy shields, like a ship?"
"No, nothing fancy like that. It's a space suit," Skippy replied.
"Huh. How do the Theranin fight in these things?"
"Fight?" Skippy laughed. "The Theranin don't typically go into combat themselves. Those little green pinheads aren't going to expose themselves to danger directly. They remotely control military drones. You'd probably call them combat droids or robots or something like that."
"Combat droids? Are there combat droids aboard this ship?"
"Of course. There's 36 of them in the ship's armory."
There was an implied duh in Skippy's voice. 38 units, to be exact."
"Armory? What armory?" I asked.
"We have combat robots?" Giraud demanded. "This would have been a good thing to know before I spent days planning an assault. There are combat robots, rifles, rockets, and all kinds of toys in the armory. It's located aft of the command section. It's kind of hidden. You have to know where it is."
"Why the hell didn't you tell us about this?" I didn't try to keep the frustration out of my voice.
"Well, Joe, you didn't ask," Skippy grumbled. "And I'm not going to volunteer to tell a bunch of monkeys where they can find dangerous toys to play with."
"Merde." Giraud's face was red.
"Colonel, if you ever feel like throwing Skippy out of an airlock, let me know, and I will be very happy to take care of it for you."
"What?" Skippy asked innocently.
"What did I do?"
I gave Giraud a thumbs up. "Skippy, if you don't already know, I can't explain it to you. These combat robots, are humans capable of controlling them, or is that something the Theranin do through their cybernetics?"
"The Theranin use cybernetics, sure. That is one of the most efficient ways to telefactor a remote device, especially in combat where response time is critical. There's no reason we can't hook something up for humans to be the telefactoring agent."
It would have been helpful for me if Skippy bothered to explain unfamiliar technical terms.
"To be clear, telefactoring is remote control? With what? Joysticks? Buttons? That sort of thing?"
Skippy made a raspberry sound.
"As if. No way, dude. That would be way too slow. What, you think this is 1985 and you're playing Super Mario?
We'll attach sensors to the operators so the robots will move as they move. Motion capture, only way better than the technology you monkeys have.
Now that I think about it, we'll need goggles also so the operator can see what the robot sees. That's not as efficient as hooking directly into the optic nerve like the Theranin do. It should be good enough. And the sensors should include accelerometers so the operator can get a sense of feedback when the robot encounters resistance."
"Would you kindly unlock the armory so us grubby monkeys can see these amazing robots?" I put as much sarcasm into my voice as I could.
"Since you asked so nicely, sure."
Skippy couldn't resist a dig at us.
"Wash your paws first, though, please."
The droids were impressive, although Sergeant Adams quickly coined the term combot for them. According to her, they weren't true androids, as they had only a limited ability to move and react on their own, requiring control by a sentient operator. Once we got 3 combots out of the armory and into an empty cargo bay, Giraud, Adams, and Thompson were able to control them without any special gear, simply by having Skippy watch their movements and instruct the combots to follow. "In action, we wouldn't be able to rely on Skippy," he cautioned. The asteroid base was heavily shielded, and operators needed to be close to their combat to reduce the time lag. During the raid, operators had to be aboard the dropships in the landing bay. I wasn't happy about that. We'd be exposing more people to risk, even if the risk to them was less than the people wearing Krystang-powered armor suits. We still needed people in suits on the raid. Skippy didn't trust combat with tasks that required fine motor skills like selecting, picking up, and transporting the fragile ancient elder gear he needed. Also, with only combats, we'd have all our eggs in one basket. According to the Krystang and Theranan data Skippy had downloaded, the Krystang had designed their defenses specifically to protect against the Theranan, and Skippy couldn't guarantee the Krystang didn't have some ability to interfere with the telefactoring connection. The Krystang knew all about Theranan combats and would have spent a lot of time and effort figuring out how to beat them. Giroux's revised plan called for 6 people wearing Krystang suits and 9 telefactor operators in the dropships. Skippy would remotely fly the dropships, which meant we didn't need to dedicate people as pilots. I wanted at least 4 people trained to fly Theranan dropships anyway. 6 people needed to have Krystang suits adjusted to fit them, then practice using them in combat simulations. 4 people needed training to fly Theranan dropships, and it had to be minimal training, because those same people, along with almost everyone else, had to practice telefactoring combats. For the raid, I reluctantly agreed with Giroux, Chang, and Sims that I would remain behind aboard the Dutchman, along with Skippy, Desai, and Private Walorski. Walorski had been awakened and released from the medical pod by Skippy after he decided Walorski had healed sufficiently to go through the remainder of the healing regimen on his own. On his own, except that his left forearm that had been shattered and almost severed during the battle to capture the flower was encased in a rigid sleeve that was designed for Theranan legs. It was a bit too large for Walorski's forearm, enough that he kept bumping it on things, causing him pain and causing Dr. Skippy endless frustration. Every time the healing forearm was disturbed, it set back Walorski's recovery ever so slightly. The sleeve contained nanoprobes that were knitting Walorski's bones, nerves, and musculature back together. There were vials of fluids that needed to be changed 3 times a day. Skippy predicted a complete recovery, with the sleeve able to be removed in 3 weeks, possibly sooner if Walorski cooperated. Certainly a much better prognosis than what we'd feared originally, that of Walorski losing his left arm below the elbow, and very likely dying given the scant medical supplies we'd brought along and lack of a human doctor. You'd think Walorski would be grateful, and he was. He was also a soldier, and he saw everyone else except for me and Desai practicing with either Krystang-powered armor or with combats. Walorski protested that he should be given a combat, that he should go along in a dropship on the raid, that he wasn't qualified as a pilot and didn't want to stay behind while everyone else risked their lives in a battle that was crucial for the survival of humanity. He said this to me, his commanding officer, who would be staying behind while everyone else risked their lives in a battle that was crucial for the survival of humanity. Walorski needed to work on his people skills, that was for certain. Would I have felt the same way, not wanting to be left behind while my fellow soldiers fought the enemy? Hell yes, I did feel that way. The raid on the asteroid would likely determine whether our home planet, our entire species, remained under the boot of the Krystang, might determine if humanity survived in any recognizable fashion. No way in hell did I want to remain behind in relative safety on the Dutchman, able to jump away if the ship was threatened. After the battle, whatever happened, I'd forever know that my part in the action had been to sit in a chair. And everyone else would know it too. My attempts to convince Private Walorski that he was needed aboard the Dutchman as a backup pilot were hindered by the fact that I wasn't entirely convinced myself. He was verging on open insubordination when Skippy intervened by stating Walorski couldn't be useful as a combat controller without full use of his left hand. Walorski could assist Desai in flying the ship with one hand or he could sit around doing nothing, but he would only get in the way on the raid. It was a contest who was more unhappy. Me, Walorski. There was one large group of unhappy people aboard the ship. Everyone who was training with powered armor or combats in the cargo bay we'd set up for combat drills. They were unhappy because Giroux had made the mistake of assigning Sergeant Adams to the task of converting a cargo bay into a combat simulator and designing the training program. Neither of those were a problem. The problem was that as she was in charge of the training,
She picked the music that blasted out of speakers in the cargo bay. Loud music was distracting, and it helped to train people to work while distracted and while their ears were assaulted by noise so loud you couldn't think straight, like what happened in combat. Loud music wasn't the problem. The problem was Adams's atrocious taste in music. When I'm training for some intense physical activity, whether for combat or simply working out in a gym, I want some heart-pounding, fist-pumping tunes, rock and roll, rap, something with a good beat to it. And what Adams used for a playlist was gospel music, Cajun, jazz, polka, and I kid you not, bluegrass. Blue fucking grass, like banjos and guys singing through their nose in that whiny affectation that makes me want to break the banjo over the guy's head. I'm not a big bluegrass fan, in case you were wondering. Country, yes. Bluegrass, no. And none of the songs were good examples of their genre. Adams had definitely dug way down to find the kind of crap songs artists use to pad their albums when they run out of ideas or talent or both. Oh, and she'd play the same awful song over and over and over and over. Try concentrating with that blast in your ears. It turns out, Adams is an evil genius. If you like the music you're listening to, you can get into a rhythm, and it's not distracting. If the music is like fingernails on a chalkboard to your ears, you're going to devote part of your thinking capacity to daydreams about the best way to kill the person who picked the playlist, and you're going to be distracted, and the whole point of the training is for you to learn how to concentrate and ignore distractions. It was effective. The music still sucked, effective or not. The first time I watched an exercise, as soon as it was over, I went old school and put on some Coolio. That got me a relieved thumbs up from the crew. It was the best morale booster since the crew had watched our unwanted Kristang ships disappear in an antimatter fireball within the gas giant. Score one for me. After watching the crew drill with powered armor or combox, I was impressed and beginning to have hope we could pull off the raid successfully. Our six mech soldiers and their Kristang armored suits were fast and could carry the heavy Kristang rifles easily. The asteroid's gravity was only 2% of Earth normal, so for training, Skippy reduced gravity in the training cargo bay to 2%. 2% meant people in suits and combots needed some way other than gravity to avoid floating off the floor in the research base. The combots automatically gripped floors, walls, ceilings, whatever they needed to in order to move where the operator wanted them to go. They had gripper pads on their feet, knees, hands, elbows, anywhere it might be useful. The Kristang suits had grippers on the bottoms of their boots and palms of their gloves, of course, but also at the elbows, shoulders, back of the helmet, knees, and on the suit's butt. Our suited soldiers needed to learn how to turn on and off and adjust the force of the grippers. Overall, we were not concerned about the ability of the combots to maneuver as required. The powered armor suits took a lot of practice to get used to. The problem the suited soldiers had in the combat training maze Adams had set up was not getting around corners and through doors. It was dialing down their speed and power. They were moving too fast and bouncing off walls. Three suits got busted in training. We had six spares aboard the Flower and spare parts. What we didn't have were many humans over 6 feet tall. I advised Giroux to slow down and take it easy. We couldn't afford for anyone to get injured during training. People wearing the suits were sore enough without crashing into things. Even at the maximum limits of adjustment, the suits were too big. We put padding in the boots to lift up people's feet. It helped somewhat. I tried on a suit, and at 6'3", I felt it digging into my knees, my crotch, under my arms, and I had to stretch my neck to avoid banging my chin on the bottom of the helmet. The Kristang suits were impressive. The Theranin combots were awesome. There were two types of combots. We used the smaller one exclusively, as Skippy said the larger heavy model might not fit through passageways in the asteroid base. The smaller combot had three legs for stability and three arms. Two arms were for stability or climbing. The arm in the center was for weapon attachments, and Skippy had fabricated goggles that allowed our operators to both see through the combot's optical sensors and also control the guns. The guns pointed wherever the operator looked, with crosshairs and the goggles for aiming. Skippy's original plan was for the operator to control the weapon triggers by blinking. Giroux had squashed that idiotic plan by pointing out that most human blinking was involuntary.
At Giraud's suggestion, the trigger was controlled by the operator's index finger, either left or right, depending on the person. Selection of weapon, the rifle or the rocket grenade launcher, was controlled by the operator's thumb. We couldn't use live ammo aboard the Dutchman. That was a problem, since doing that would be best for the operators to get a real sense of their weapon's effectiveness. Skippy warned that even inside the asteroid base, where there was little concern about tearing a hole in the asteroid's thick skin and causing an atmospheric containment breach, we should use the rockets and grenades sparingly on our way in. On our way back, to provide cover, we could blast anything we saw. The plan was to blow up the entire asteroid anyway, to erase any trace that humans had ever been there. The actual raid went perfectly according to Skippy and Giraud's plan. At first. And then it all went to shit. Before we made the jump into the star system that contained the asteroid base, the entire crew other than Desai and Walorski assembled in the dropship bay. It was time for one last equipment check, to make absolutely sure that everything the raiding party needed was loaded aboard the two dropships, and everything was working properly. An extra combat was loaded aboard each dropship, making the already snug interior even more cramped. The Theranin may have built high ceilings into their star carriers to accommodate guests. They hadn't done that with their dropships. The dropships were so cramped that the six people who would be wearing Krystang armor needed to get into the armor before boarding the dropships, despite the extra time they'd have to spend in the uncomfortable suits. After supervising the inspection, Giraud gave a short but effective speech, much better than anything I would have said. He didn't use any fiery language or try to inspire people. They didn't need inspiration. He simply stated that we would only get one chance at this raid, one chance to free Earth from the Krystang. No matter what the cost, we were not leaving the asteroid without the wormhole controller module. Everyone had studied the mock-up Skippy had fabricated. The module was a long, skinny box about 4 feet long and 6 inches on each side. Skippy said it folded out and expanded to make an X 10 feet across. Anyone who saw a module would pick it up if they were wearing a Krystang suit, or signal a suit wearer and wait if they were operating a combat. We couldn't risk damage to the module by attempting to pick up the module with a combat. Even our most gentle operators routinely crushed things with the combat's immense strength. Without cybernetics, the operator lacked enough feedback to avoid crushing objects in the combat's grasping claws. Combats would lead the way through the base, with our 6 suit wearers in the rear. Giraud told me he would have liked another 2 weeks of combat practice. He didn't say that to the crew. Skippy was anxious to hit the asteroid base as soon as possible. With the fluid military situation in the sector, he was concerned the Krystang would reinforce their asteroid research base, or worse, pack up anything of value and take it away, disperse the stuff across the stars. We couldn't take that risk, so I decided we'd jump into battle as soon as possible. Before we launched the raid, Chang and Giraud had a conversation with me. They wanted me to assure them that if that raid looked like it was going to fail and humanity's involvement was at risk of being exposed, I would not hesitate to blow the asteroid and jump away. If we couldn't recover the flower, I'd need to vaporize that ship also. It was dusted with human DNA. Chang and Giraud made me promise, because they knew I'd be going against every instinct I had as a soldier, that I wouldn't hesitate to abandon the raiders and escape, live to fight another day. Despite what Giraud told the crew about the raid being our only chance, humanity still had some chance as long as Skippy was safe and on our side. If the raid failed, the Dutchman could try to pick up new crew members at Paradise or Earth and continue to search for a wormhole controller module. I didn't see how that would work, but it was not completely impossible. I promised. It made me feel like shit, but I did it. I owed it to our crew. They were willing to risk their lives on this crazy mission. I needed to understand the mission was worth their lives, however the mission ended. Walorski had no idea how much I didn't want to remain aboard the Dutchman while our crew, my crew, went on the raid. We jumped in close to the asteroid, within 2 million miles. The jump in and subsequent maneuvers were pre-programmed by Skippy because the timing was so tight. All Desai did was press a button on my command. A split second after we jumped in, the flower was ejected, performed a micro-jump, and the Dutchman did a short-range jump in the opposite direction. The flower formed a jump point for another micro-jump, then the field collapsed as planned, and the flower tumbled, dead in space. The effect, according to Skippy's logic,
was for the immediate area to be flooded with overlapping jump field waves, masking the presence of a second ship. The flower tumbled out of control, thrusters firing randomly, with the ship leaking radiation. We wanted the flower to attract attention, while the Dutchman zipped away unseen. Skippy had the flower broadcasting the IFF codes of a frigate that had disappeared in the area 2 years before, during a skirmish with another Kristang clan. Our hope was the Kristang would be confused and curious enough not to immediately blast the flower to pieces. The more the Kristang investigated the flower, the less they'd be likely to notice the Dutchman. It worked. By the time the Kristang directed their sensors to widen their scanning radius, Skippy was in their network and directing the system to ignore the huge Theranin star carrier sneaking up to their front door. We tripped the stealth detection grids as we passed through their field lines, and the sensors identified us. The Kristang computers simply ignored those inputs. Desai parked the Dutchman behind an asteroid 2,000 miles away from the target, and Skippy launched the dropships. When Skippy first told us we would be raiding an asteroid, the picture I had in my mind was a jagged, irregular chunk of rock, like asteroids in space movies. This asteroid was technically a planetoid. It was almost 300 miles in diameter, big enough that its gravity had shaped it into a sphere. Still, it was a pockmarked, ugly gray and brown, frozen and desolate pile of rock. On one side was the research base, on the other, a much larger Kristang military base. A large military base with 1,000 soldiers, assault dropships, gunships, and enough missiles to blow the Flying Dutchman to pieces. Hanging around somewhere in the area was a squadron of frigates, 6 destroyers and a cruiser. And we were going to bust in, take what we wanted, and get away cleanly. Skippy was true to his word. The military base was interested in the flower and detached a pair of frigates and 4 dropships to investigate our decoy. The military base had sent a message to the research base to go on high alert. The research base never received that message because Skippy intercepted it. But Skippy replied for them, so the military base thought everything had been locked down. We had nearly complete surprise when the dropships approached the docking bay doors. The docking bay controller thought the doors were opening for a pair of Kristang dropships sent to reinforce security, and that's what Skippy told the base computers to display. Our dropships landed and deployed combots with our 6 soldiers in powered armor suits. Everything would have gone perfectly, except that there was a Kristang maintenance technician in a spacesuit working on the mechanism just inside the door. He saw with his own eyes that our dropships were Theranin. No way Skippy could hack his optic nerve. And this dedicated worker did his duty and shouted a warning on the radio. A warning that got buried by Skippy. When no one responded, the Eager Beaver Kristang ran across the bay and pulled a lever that triggered a hardwired alarm. The only way for Skippy to kill a hardwired alarm was to burn out the hardline electric circuit, which he did with a power surge after the alarm rang out twice. And he instructed the computer to announce the alarm was false, that it had been triggered by the power surge. That would have bought us another 2 minutes, enough time for the raiding party to place explosive charges on the inner door and blow it in a controlled fashion. It would have, except the model citizen Kristang knew something was extra wrong when the alarm only sounded twice and he sprinted toward a weapons locker. That drew the attention of the raiding party, who gave our Kristang Employee of the Year his reward, not in the form of cash or a prime parking space, but by concentrated fire from a 6 combots. And that's when the trouble started, when the Kristang disappeared in a cloud of bloody vapor. The explosive rounds our keyed-up pirates selected for their combots went right through the Kristang and hammered into the wall of the docking bay. The Kristang and the research base didn't need any electronic means to notify them that something was majorly wrong. They could feel the vibration of the explosive rounds through the floors and walls. At that point, Giraud ordered the combots to clear a lane, and he wasted the inner door with a rocket. He had the warhead selected for shape charge. The door exploded inward. This was less than optimal because part of the door was still hanging in jagged pieces attached to the frame. This is where our lack of experience hurt us. Giraud should have dialed the rocket warhead for a wider blast instead of maximum penetration. The door was tough, but not armored. At that point, blasting the wall on either side of the door to clear a path would have sent debris flying all over. So we wasted time having a pair of combots rip the doorway clear with their grappler claws. One of the combots was a bit too enthusiastic and used too much force, A big chunk of door and frame came flying across the docking bay in the low gravity and narrowly missed knocking out a Combot. The human operator of the Combot couldn't react in time. The Combot's automatic systems made it duck out of the way, allowing the chunk of door to hit Chang on his left side. The impact sent Chang flying across the bay, ruptured his pressure suit, and cracked several ribs. We later learned two of his ribs were broken. I'd fallen off a dirt bike once and cracked a rib. The pain had me crawling on my knees trying to catch my breath, except that breathing made the pain even worse. It took me an hour of sitting or laying on the ground before I was able to get back on the dirt bike and very slowly ride back home, where my parents took me to the hospital. Chang's Kristang suit lining had a gel that hardened on exposure to vacuum. It sealed the hole to prevent his air from leaking out. Somehow, even though it must have been incredibly painful, Chang got back to his feet and back into action on adrenaline and pure guts. The guy was spitting up blood, and that didn't stop him. Skippy was showing data from the medical monitors in Chang's suit. It looked bad. I don't know how Chang wasn't curled up in a ball on the deck, and I wanted to tell him to pull back to a dropship and let the raiding party continue the mission. I didn't do that. I needed to trust that if Chang couldn't continue, he'd tell me. And Giroux was there with Chang. If Giroux thought Chang was combat ineffective, Giroux would signal me privately. We needed Chang. We needed everyone. As long as he wasn't a liability to the mission, I wasn't going to interfere from 10,000 miles away. The motors in his powered armor and the low gravity may have helped take part of the strain from Chang. We'd need to see how he handled combat. With the inner door cleared, the raiding party surged down the corridor, Combots in front, then the six people in suits, followed by two Combots as rear guard. They quickly ran into another door, which they spent the extra 30 seconds on to blow properly with explosives. After that, they were in the main part of the research base, and Skippy could open and close doors for them. Right away, we encountered a problem. Skippy by that time had infiltrated the base computer and searched the archives. Archives that he said were an incredibly crappy mishmash of unindexed, uncatalogued, random garbage. Regardless of his difficulties, he located the two items we wanted to steal. A wormhole controller module and a sort of communications node that was associated with the collective. The two items were stored in different compartments. Fortunately, neither item was considered a priority by the Kristang researchers, and they were both in low-security areas away from the main research facilities. I had to make a decision quick, whether to go after the items one after the other or split the raiding party. Dividing a force goes against the principles of war that the Army had taught me. As I was thinking about it, the words of the U.S. Army Field Manual popped into my head. Dividing a force in a situation where we're already outnumbered and outgunned violated the military principles of mass and economy of force. No matter. The possibility of having to divide the raiding party had been discussed in advance, with Chang, Giroux, Sims, and I in agreement. In this case, concentration of force was secondary to the principle of surprise. Our raiding party could only succeed, could only hope to survive, if they got in and got out as fast as possible before the Kristang could recover from their own surprise, figure out what the hell was going on, and concentrate their own forces against us. The longer the raiding party was in the base, the longer they were exposed to danger. I gave the order for Chang to take one group to get the comm node, and for Giroux to get the wormhole controller module. Unspoken in that order is that I felt Chang, being injured, was the weaker of the two, and I wanted the wormhole controller module a lot more than I wanted a fancy radio for Skippy to talk to ancient AIs. For a moment, I considered keeping a pair of Combots at the point where the party split to guard a path for their retreat, until Skippy showed me a schematic of the base. There were a lot of corridor intersections the parties would need to transit. Guarding only one was a waste of firepower. From there, the raid proceeded fast and chaotically, according to plan for the most part. The Kristang were seriously off balance. Their internal systems had been hardened in anticipation of attack by rival Kristang clans or Theranin. They had not anticipated Skippy thoroughly infiltrating their systems. What systems he didn't have control of, he weakened, confused, shorted out, or cut power to. The Kristang frantically called the military base on the other side of the asteroid, messages that Skippy intercepted, and Skippy sent back fake messages that the military base was under heavy attack and would send reinforcements when they could. Some extra quick-thinking Kristang, no doubt runner-up for Employee of the Year, fired off a rocket flare that was supposed to signal the military base that something was seriously wrong. The flare made a grand firework when it cleared the horizon, and I had a moment of panic. Skippy calmed me down by assuring that although the Kristang sensor network saw the flare signal, he instructed the sensors to ignore it. The military base was buried deep beneath the rock. Unless some Kristang was on the surface for some reason, no one would see the flare. And since Skippy was squelching radio traffic, a Kristang would need to be on the surface, see the flare, know what it meant, run back to the military base and knock on the door. I figured that was low risk. Skippy prevented more flare rockets from firing by igniting the whole remaining canister of them without opening the silo door. The resulting explosion may have put a damper on the prospects of Employee of the Year runner-up ever getting a shiny plaque to put on his desk, since the explosion wiped out a pretty serious chunk of the base and likely killed him. Personally, I was okay with that. The Combots were having success. It helped that the Kristang security force had, according to their established protocol, retreated to protect the high-security research center of the base, the most obvious target. They didn't realize that we were going after a different part of the base. Skippy reported the Kristang were thoroughly confused, panicked, in disarray, unable to understand what was happening, and why their carefully hardened systems weren't working or were working against them. Power surges had burned out the door controls, lifts, lights, and life support in the parts of the base we didn't care about. Many of the Kristang were isolated, trapped, slow to react, and leaderless. The little resistance the raiding party encountered on their way in were lone individuals or small groups of two or three, uncoordinated, ineffective. The Kristang's ineffectual efforts against us actually helped our combat operators gain experience with live fire. They learned real quick to use quick bursts with the rounds dialed to minimal explosive force and on fragmentation setting. The high explosive rock and roll the operators used against the first pair of Kristang tore the enemy apart. It also wasted ammunition and blasted the corridor, creating debris the raiding party had to maneuver around. Giroux was rightly pissed. He'd warned people not to go crazy with the advanced Theranin weapons. They paid attention after that first encounter. Chang's team reached their objective first, only to find a disorganized room full of junk. Not junk stacked on shelves, helpfully labeled, not even junk stuffed into boxes. This junk was in piles. Like the Kristang had opened the door, tossed stuff in, and closed the door. "Oh, shit," Skippy groaned. "I didn't anticipate this. The database shows the communications node was last logged as being in that room. There are no sensors in the room, not even a camera." "Any magic you can perform?" I asked anxiously. "Doing the best I can," Skippy said defensively. "For secrecy, there are not a lot of sensors inside the research base except for the access points and living quarters. Also, the base was specifically designed to make remote surveillance difficult. I'm mostly blind in there. Not nearly as blind as the Kristang expect, and more than I'm comfortable with. There are a significant number of Kristang security personnel that I have lost track of. I don't know where they are or what they're doing. There are also areas of the base the raiding party has shown on cameras that aren't in the schematics I have access to. I'm collating data to develop a true layout of the base. My earnest suggestion is the raiding party move as quickly as possible." "Wow, what a great idea. I hadn't thought of that." That's what ran through my mind, not what I said to Skippy. "Colonel Chang," I said through the Z-phone, "you'll have to dig through that pile to find the comm node. You know what the thing looks like." Every member of the raiding party had seen the model Skippy fabricated of the two items we needed to steal.
"Yes, acknowledged," Chang said.
His voice was strained. There was a rattle in his throat. On the displays, I could see Chang, Darzi, and Asok Putri walk into the room and begin sorting through the pile. Chang was moving very stiffly. Because of his injury, he didn't get down on the floor. He started with the top of the pile. He kept them organized, keeping items they'd sorted through in one pile so they didn't lose track. It was efficient, focused, as fast as possible, and way, way too slow. Chang's group was way behind schedule. It was a large room, with five piles of junk extending to the ceiling, and after 5 minutes, they'd only sorted halfway through one pile. Giroux's team had reached their target. He had the luck that day, as the room with the wormhole controller module was as organized as Chang's target was disorganized. Giroux, Sergeant Thompson, and Private Marsden raced down the aisles, showing the contents of the shelves to Skippy, who quickly deciphered the indexing system and directed Sergeant Thompson exactly to where the wormhole controller module was, sitting on a shelf.
"Target acquired," Giroux reported. "Heading back now. Advice, should we proceed directly back to the docking bay or help Colonel Chang's team?"
Chang's team was taking way too long. Crap, they expected me to make this call. Send Giroux's team to speed up the search for the comm node in hope of speeding up the search? Diverting Giroux's team risked exposing them to danger longer. That risked us losing the wormhole controller module. Did I consider bailing on trying to find Skippy's comm node now that we had the wormhole controller module? Not really. I thought about that issue over the last week. It had kept me awake at night. We cared about shutting down the wormhole. It was all I cared about. It was the entire purpose of the mission. I would sacrifice anything to achieve it. We humans truly did not care whether Skippy... I cared a little bit because I liked Skippy and felt we owed it to him. And sometimes thought I understood his terrible, ancient, aching loneliness. My personal feelings had to be put aside. As the commander, I needed to focus on the mission and my people. What I'd decided ahead of time was that regardless of my promise to Skippy, if there was any way we could shut down the wormhole without Skippy, I was not going to risk people's lives and the mission to get his magical radio. We had no way to shut down the wormhole on our own, making my decision easy, if hard to swallow. Lieutenant Giroux, take your team to assist Colonel Chang. We need to move as fast as possible. Whatever Giroux thought of the wisdom of my decision, he didn't argue. Acknowledged, we're on our way. On the display, I saw Chang, Putri, and Darzi were sorting through the piles of junk as fast as they could. Chang had ordered a combat into the room, not to touch anything, but to use its cameras, hoping Skippy could find the thing. It was all taking way too long. Skippy telling me he'd lost track of the Kristang, that even he was mostly blind, had me extremely anxious. Skippy, this comm node thing is for communications, right?
Yeah, duh, so?
So can you contact it? Use it to send out a signal that you can use to find the damn thing?
Shit. Yes.
Duh. I couldn't resist, partly from nervous energy.
Damn it. I don't know what is wrong with me sometimes. Of course, yes. Have Chang, Putri, and Darzi spread out so I can use their suit radios to triangulate.
I did. Less than a minute later, Skippy found it in the pile of junk way in the back. Chang had Darzi and Putri climb over the pile in between and toss useless crap out of the way until they had uncovered the top third of the pile. Then they proceeded more carefully. Darzi found the stupid thing. It looked exactly as Skippy said. On the display, I saw that Giroux's team was close to Chang's location, close enough that I judged it best for them to link up and support each other on the retreat, even though that meant having all our eggs in one basket. That's when things went to shit in a hurry. The first sign of trouble was not a warning from Skippy. It was not the combats encountering Kristang fighters in front of them. It was a hail of bullets hitting Giroux and Putri from behind, knocking them both down. Putri took several hits dead center and was killed instantly. The explosive-tipped rounds fortunately missed the wormhole controller module that was in a sling on its back. Giroux went down with a glancing hit to the side of his helmet, a hard blow to his lower back, and a round that hit his left arm and severed his forearm halfway between wrist and elbow. Darzi reacted exactly as he should have, as he was trained to do. He dropped to the deck, clearing the way for the combats to engage. Darzi crawled forward, keeping low, and tore the straps off Putri's sling. Darzi saw Putri was beyond help, and he correctly focused on keeping to the mission objective. Our combats swiveled to engage the six enemy soldiers who were wearing heavy armor. It was a vicious firefight, and Darzi couldn't do anything to help. He had to keep his head down and shelter the vital module behind Giroux's unmoving form. On the display, I could see Giroux was alive, unconscious, and not bleeding seriously.
"Skippy," I shouted frantically, "is there another way back to the docking bay?"
Four of the Kristang were still alive and taking cover in doorways and side corridors. They had the combats fully engaged. Darzi, with the module, couldn't move without exposing the precious module. Chang's team was running to assist. They couldn't arrive for another 2 minutes, maybe less. Too long.
"Yes, plenty of alternate routes exist."
"Great. Combat operators, don't worry about damage in the corridor. We'll be taking another route back. Take out those Kristang, maximum force." That was all the combat operators needed to hear.
Three of them dialed their rockets up to maximum yield, shaped charge, and blew the hell out of the corridor beyond Darcy and Giroux. Rockets penetrated two or three compartments deep, destroying the four Cristang, blasting walls, floors, and collapsing the ceiling.
"Darcy," I shouted when my voice should have remained calm. "Get up! Lieutenant Giroux is alive. Can you carry Giroux?"
"Yes, sir."
Darcy could easily carry Giroux in the low gravity, especially in his powered armor. He got the module slung over his back, tied the straps quickly, and picked up Giroux's unconscious body. The combats led the way. I warned them as Chang's team approached so the two groups didn't shoot at each other. They linked up, and Skippy guided them.